Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down.
Our guest this week grew up in Oak Park, Michigan, earned a BA in political science and government from Kalamazoo College, and a JD in law from the George Washington University Law School. From 2009 to 2015, he was the Chief Judge of the United States District Court. In 2013, he served as the Chief Judicial Mediator for the Detroit bankruptcy case, the largest, most complex municipal bankruptcy in our nation's history, which resulted in an agreed-upon consensual plan of adjustment in just 17 months. The savior of Detroit, his name, the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula, this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen, the architect of the Grand Bargain. Your Honor, welcome, a real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Great to be here.
Let's start by talking about your mom and your dad and your childhood, please.
I grew up in Oak Park in the 50s, which was very much a bedroom community of Detroit. My dad was a baseball player who chased his dreams for 4 years in the Chicago Cubs farm system and then came to Detroit to sell furnaces. My mother was a psychologist. Some say that's evident with all of my problems. But I had two brothers and had a very middle-class upbringing on Clover Lawn and Oak Park.
What's the biggest thing, Your Honor, you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
My dad always drummed into all of us, particularly me, I was the firstborn, that once a task is once begun, never leave it till it's done. Be of labor, great or small, do it well or not at all. And I still hear his voice resounding.
And from Mom?
My mother was very much into academia and reading, and she taught me to read before I even went to kindergarten, and it's a gift that I carry with me all through my life.
In the mid-70s, for 5 years, you were a United States Senate legislative assistant. Talk about that chapter of your life.
So I went to Washington at the end of 1973, and I worked for then-Senator, United States Senator, Bob Griffin from Michigan. Senator Griffin then went on to become the Republican leader in the Senate, and I learned a tremendous amount in that job. I learned to write quickly. I learned to negotiate because I did some floor work for him on the Senate floor, negotiating amendments and legislation, and I suppose that was a great way to learn how to negotiate with people and to deal with people, understand the other side's problems, understand the other side's issues, understand what motivated the other side. And Senator Griffin was a great mentor.
All right, from 79 to 1990, you were a senior partner at Miller Canfield. Talk about that chapter of your life, please.
I came back to Detroit, I was asked to join the firm of Miller Canfield, which at the time was the largest and oldest firm in the state. And I did a lot of different kinds of litigation. I did commercial litigation. I did employment litigation. I did First Amendment litigation. And that exposed me to a wide variety of cases and types of areas of the law.
And what was your specialty? What was your practice?
I was a trial lawyer. I took what came in the door, which was unusual. Most of the lawyers in our litigation department did have a focus or a specialty, as you indicated, but I did a lot of different kinds of practice. But as I said, commercial law, employment law, constitutional law, some First Amendment law, that was probably the steadiest diet that I had.
All right. In late 1989... President George H.W. Bush nominates you for the United States District Court, the Eastern District of Michigan. How did that come to be?
Well, I had, in several ways, actually, I had been active in the Republican Party and had met President Bush. He was vice president when I met him. I was general counsel for the party, for the Republican Party. I was also co-chairing a committee to select federal judges. So in 1989, the former chief judge of the court, Phil Pratt, passed away, and there was a vacancy, so I thought I would put my name in. I was only 37 years old, and the stars just lined up, and I was selected by President Bush to serve on the court.
What was it like going from this side of the bench, Jerry, to now the other side of the bench?
A little surreal. When I first became a judge, I was very young for a federal judge, and I remember when I first walked in the courtroom and everybody stood up, I thought my father had walked in. But, you know, you adjust to the role. I tried very hard, worked very hard, tried to be a good judge, a fair judge, tried to follow the law and do what I thought was right under the law.
You had a lot of lawyers come in front of you, petition to you. What do all great lawyers have in common?
The ability to distill to their essence the strengths of their case and not avoid the weaknesses, but to take the weaknesses and be able to explain them in clear terms and explain why I shouldn't, the judge, why I shouldn't be distracted by the weaknesses in their case.
All right. From 2009 to 2015, you were the chief judge of that court. What did those roles entail?
It's largely administrative, although in my case it was kind of unusual. My predecessor, Chief Judge Bernie Friedman, he unfortunately contracted a very serious disease, cancer, in mid-2007. And he called me to tell me that and to tell me he was taking a leave of absence. And so I was parachuted into the role without much notice, actually. So from the middle of 2007 until the beginning of 2009, I was sort of the acting chief judge. So by the time I became chief, I'd actually been doing it for about a year and a half. You know, there were a lot of challenges. One of the challenges that we had was Congress had sequestered all of our funding, the judiciary's funding. So along with a number of other chief judges, I served on a committee to try to persuade Congress of the error of its ways. Fortunately, we were at least partially successful and got much of our funding restored. So that was a big challenge. Another big challenge was in just keeping up with the administrative work. The administrative work of administering a large district court, and we were the eighth largest federal district court in the country, is really pretty challenging. We're doing budget, we're doing personnel. It may not be efficient, but it's challenging. Dealing with problems from colleagues, dealing with problems from staff. So it's a pretty challenging and time-consuming job.
We're talking to the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen. When we come back, we're going to ask him about him becoming the chief judicial mediator for the famous Detroit bankruptcy case 10 years ago. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen. In 2013, he was named the Chief Judicial Mediator for the famous Detroit bankruptcy case. Let's go back to 2013, Your Honor. Paint for us a picture of the financial situation in Detroit.
Detroit was in desperate. Just in desperate straits. It's even hard to describe how bad it was. 40% of all the lights in the city were out. There were 150,000 blighted homes or vacant lots. The snow wasn't being plowed. Garbage wasn't being picked up. There's a term that term that bankruptcy experts use. It's kind of a sterile term, but it's Detroit was service delivery insolvent, which means that services weren't being provided, and Detroit was really not a city. We couldn't borrow money because we were already at our statutory borrowing limits. There was only less than 8 weeks of cash to be had, and it was a pretty dire situation. And at the filing of the bankruptcy, the only real asset the city had was the treasures at the Detroit Institute of Arts, world-class museum. And a lot of the creditors and the city were looking to monetize it, another sanitary term to mean liquidate.
So you told me, Jack, really we had two bookends. On the one side, the art from the DIA, and then the other side, the pensions. Talk about the pension situation.
Yeah, the pensions were really dire. They were, by conservative estimates, they were $3.5 billion underfunded, but really it was much more than that because they were using an artificial discount rate. And the city had stopped making contributions to the pension funds, which, of course, was very serious. I mean, these were people who had worked their entire lives to serve the city, whether in uniform with the police and firefighters and the emergency medical staff, or the civilian employees like the garbage folks and the clerical folks. They'd worked their entire lives, and their pensions were not plush. The civilians made only about $19,000 or $20,000 on average in their pensions, and the uniform folks only about $32,000, but they weren't eligible for Social Security, and some weren't eligible for Medicare. So it was a very serious matter, and the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, was threatening to cut their pensions by 35-40%. So it was a very serious matter. And you're right, I did begin to think of the bankruptcy as bookended by the art on the one hand, because it was really the only significant asset that the city had, and on the other hand, the retirees. If you include their retirement health care, between that and the pensions, they were the largest single creditors. The healthcare retiree system was almost $6 billion underfunded. So between the two, it was almost $10 billion.
We're talking to the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen, who's written a book, just published, Grand Bargain, The Inside Story of Detroit's Dramatic Journey from Bankruptcy to Rebirth. And in the book, you talk about, I quote you, without Jake... and Jerry, not the Jake from State Farm Insurance, there is no grand bargain. Please.
Jake was 15 years old, and I was struggling when Steve Rhodes, the bankruptcy judge of the case, asked me to be the judicial mediator. I was struggling with whether to do it. There were a lot of challenges. My dance card was pretty full. I had my responsibilities as chief judge. I had my judicial docket. I was teaching at Wayne Law School, actually. I was also trying to keep up with editing three different law books. So I had a pretty full dance card, as my wife reminded me. So it was challenging. And in addition to that, some of my colleagues didn't think it was such a good idea for their chief judge to get embroiled in the bankruptcy. At the time, at the very beginning, it looked like there was a possibility that things could get very, very ugly, very fast. You may remember, Jack, that there were demonstrations at the courthouse, lots of pictures of that in the book. There were other institutional reasons why, legitimate reasons why some of my colleagues thought it was not a good idea for me to get involved. And on the home front, my wife really didn't think it was a good idea for me to get involved. She put it, you're always trying to squeeze 10 pounds of crap into a 5-pound bag, and you can never say no. But it was a challenge, and I love the city, and it was an opportunity for me to do it, but I needed to find a way. And I was caught in kind of a dilemma. I also had to be concerned about what was good for my court. As the leader of the court, I had to be very concerned about the interests of the court and the court's standing in the community. So I wasn't sleeping very well, to be honest, which is not a usual condition for me. I'm usually fairly decisive. But Jake and I were riding out to play golf on a Saturday morning, and Steve Rhodes called me. Steve was, as I said, the presiding judge in the bankruptcy case, and he asked me if I'd made a decision yet on whether to do the mediator thing, as we called it. And I said I had not. I told him a little bit elliptically that I was getting some pushback from some of my colleagues, and I had to think about it very carefully. Jake didn't say anything, but when we were driving back from the golf game, in case anybody's interested, he beat me by more than 20 strokes. Jake looks at me very intently, and he has a way of just distilling things. And he said to me, "Dad, what would Churchill have done?" Now, I've been a Churchillian since college. I've read many, many, many books. Jake knew this. He'd heard all the speeches. And he just crystallized it for me. He said, "Dad, what would Churchill have done? Everybody has a time to stand up. This is your time." And it just kind of hit me like a bolt, really. When something like this comes from your 15-year-old son, it's quite startling. And he managed to put it in very clear terms. So when I got home, I told Lori what Jake had said, and she just smiled, shook her head, and said, "Well, I guess I'm good too."
And because of your son Jake, you became the symphony conductor, and a fabulous symphony conductor of the Grand Bargain. We're talking to the Honorable Gerald Rosen, and when we come back, we're going to ask him about the most expensive breakfast in history. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula. We're with the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen, who accepted the challenge to be the chief mediator. Your Honor, what was it like?
Well, Detroit was in desperate straits. And from my perspective as the mediator, not only was Detroit fiscally and financially dysfunctional and circling the drain, but it was also service delivery and dysfunctional, as I said. It really wasn't providing services to people and really wasn't functioning as a city. But as the mediator, for me, perhaps the most challenging thing was the city had no assets. You know, my job was to get deals. And to get deals, you have to either have money or assets that could be monetized into money to pay creditors. And the only asset the city really had was the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is a world-class museum. I'll get a plug in here. Last year and this year, it was picked as the number one art museum in the country. And I thought it would be a terrible idea to liquidate the art. But, you know, Detroit had been cannibalizing its heritage to mortgage its future for decades. And where had it gotten us? To me, this would have just been the exclamation point on Detroit's obituary, liquidating one of the great art collections in the world. And in addition to that, the only area in Detroit that was really starting to come back was Midtown, where the art museum is. And I thought that if we liquidated it, it would be like dropping a hydrogen bomb in the middle of Midtown. It would have sucked everything up. So when I realized this, I remember thinking, my God, what have I gotten myself into? You know, my job is to get deals. The only asset is the art. And my legacy is going to be selling off one of the great art collections to sheiks in Dubai and oligarchs in Russia. So in some ways, it was really a mission impossible. But like the title of your show, Jack, anything is possible. And I'm a can-do, optimistic kind of guy. My wife says it's always 78 and sunny in my world. So I started thinking about ways to put together deals that might involve monetizing the art without selling it or liquidating it in any way.
Thank you for the plug. We're talking to the Honorable Gerald Rosen, who's got a new book out, The Grand Bargain, The Inside Story of Detroit's Dramatic Journey from Bankruptcy to Rebirth.
Can I hold it up?
Sure. The most expensive breakfast in history. Please.
So we need some context for that, and I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. When I came up with this idea of the grand bargain, I knew we were going to have to go outside, use the art and to leverage raising money. So the idea, which I doodled on the cardboard backing of a legal pad, was to put the art in a trust, lock it off from all the other creditors, and use the trust to flow any money we could raise, flow it through the trust, and give it to the retirees to mitigate any pension losses they may unfortunately have to have. So I drew a little doodle. It's hanging in the DIA now. On the left was a circle with said state, because the idea was I was going to go to Rick Snyder, the governor, and ask him to kickstart the funding. And then whatever money we raised, put it in the trust and give it all to the retirees. That was the idea. And, you know, I was drawing up a play in the sand with a stick, but, you know, from like the old touch football games that we used to play, it worked.
How did you ask the governor?
Well, I asked him a number of times. I asked him a number of times, and, you know, his mantra was relentless positive action. And he's a very positive guy, but in a positive way, he said no. And his staff said no even more directly, like as in, what part of no don't you understand? Because I didn't give up. I kept asking. But what really happened was I ran into Miriam Nolan in the delicatessen across the street from the courthouse. She asked me how things were going. I kind of fluttered my hand and said, not great, but I've got an idea and I'd like to talk to you about it. So Miriam came over, and along with one of the co-mediators I appointed, Eugene Dreiker, a great man, truly a great man in Detroit's history. And I told Miriam what my idea was. Put the art in a trust, leverage it, and use that to raise money to mitigate the pension losses. And I said, I'm not getting anywhere with the governor, but I'm hoping that the foundation community might be able to help. And, you know, Miriam looked at me and she said, how much do you know about foundations, Jerry? I said, not much. And she said, I know they have a lot of money for good causes, and we need a lot of money, and Detroit's a worthy cause. And she said, the first thing she said, well, first of all, foundations really don't work together. We all sort of stick to our mission silos. And she said, even in catastrophic events like Katrina and 9/11, we really did our own mission. We talk to each other, but we stay within our you know, lane. And she said, the other thing is, it sounds like you need a lot of money quickly, and foundations don't work quickly. Even with small grants, it sounds like you need a lot of money. So we talked about it, and I asked her if she could bring her colleagues in from around the country. I would have my mediation team there and brief them. And we did that. And they came in on November 5th. We had a lengthy meeting in the courthouse, lasted over almost 4 hours, and they got interested. And that's really where the grand bargain started. Darren Walker was a brand new president of the Ford Foundation. Rip Rapson was and still is president of the Kresge Foundation. And the two of them really led the way. And Darren Walker called me about a month later to say that he was prepared to make the largest, he and his board were prepared to make the largest grant in the history of the foundation. I had no idea, of course, how much that was. I almost, you know, didn't want to ask. But he said, we're going to commit $125 million. I almost fell out of my chair. Oh. And I said, Darren, when the history of this bankruptcy is written, you will be the hero. And we had a lot of discussions, a lot of meetings, and within a month of that, the grand bargain started coming together, and we ended up raising $380 million from 13 foundations. We call them the grand bargain foundations. And so that was the first stool. The second stool was the state. As I indicated, this leg of the stool, as I indicated, the governor was not excited about what was being characterized, not by him, but others, as a bailout for Detroit. And when we got up to $291 million in commitments from the foundations, all of it was conditional upon the state participating in a substantial way. So I drove up, had a meeting with the governor, and, you know, he was an old friend. He had worked for me in 1982 when I ran for Congress. Yeah. So, we had a, as the diplomats say, full, frank, and candid conversation. And I told him we couldn't afford to leave this money on the sidelines. It was an assetless bankruptcy. And the state needed to come in. I'm going to try to telescope. I tell this more fulsomely in the book. But ultimately, he started realizing that we couldn't leave this money on the sidelines and started moving in my direction. And at the end of the meeting, after we had a further exchange, he asked the ultimate question, which was, you know, if we do this, is it going to work? Meaning, will it make a difference in the bankruptcy? And I said, if we get $350 million from the state, $350 million from the foundations, which is what we were aiming at, we're going to have to raise another $100 million, but I said, Rick, we'll make it work. And he reached over, we shook hands, and he said, this will be a partnership. But we still needed the third leg, which gets to your question, finally. So we needed to raise more money, and some of that had to come from the DIA itself, because everybody believed that because we were buying the DIA its freedom from Detroit's creditors, the DIA had to have some skin in the game. So I started talking with Gene Gargaro, or as I call him, Saint Gene, about the DIA participating meaningfully. And it was a very tough ask for the DIA, which had many, many other obligations, not the least of which was to raise enough money so that the millage didn't have to be renewed. But eventually he got to $50 million. And I knew that that probably wasn't going to be enough to either satisfy what we needed, but also to satisfy the political folks and the foundations. So I called Rick Snyder, and I told him we had a $50 million soft commitment from Gene Gargaro at the DIA, and he said, well, not sure it's going to be enough, but I'm receiving an award from a group called the Americans for Art in Washington, D.C. at the end of the month. I'm going to ask Gene to go with me. So I said, great, anything you can do, Rick. So the night before he was to go to Washington to get the award, he called me at about 10:30 at night. And he said, guess what I've been doing for the last 2 hours? I said, what's that, Rick? He said, I've got the DIA's audited financials. Remember, he's an accountant. He said, I can see a way to save them $5 to $6 million a year. I said, okay, what are you going to do with that? He said, I'm going to ask Gene for $100 million tomorrow morning. I said, Rick, get the award first. But, you know, the next day he called me late morning, early afternoon. I could tell his voice was, you know, he had a high-pitched voice to begin with, and his voice was ebullient. And he said, I had a very productive breakfast with Gene Gargaro. I said, okay, how productive? He said, I got you $100 million. I said, really? He said, yep, just like that. So my first instinct was to call Gene and confirm it, because, you know, even smart people like Rick hear what they want to hear and disregard the rest, like Paul Simon said in The Boxer. So I waited, and Gene called me, and he still sounded a little overwhelmed. And I said, how did your breakfast with the governor go? And he said, quote, that was the most expensive breakfast in history. We committed $100 million. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it.
We're talking to the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen, and he's given us the inside scoop on how it came to be. And I'm Jack Russell, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything Is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything Is Possible, and I'm Jack Crisula.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble.
The great Ernie Harwell.
My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God.
And the voices of our generation.
I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis.
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything Is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything Is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club. Developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything.
Spohome. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to the architect of the grand bargain, the Honorable Judge Gerald Rosen. New book, The Grand Bargain, has just come out. And I got to give you a plug. The 24 chapters and the names, catchy, phenomenal.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
Your Honor.
My friend Bill Leibold said that if there was a Pulitzer Prize for chapter titles, I would win it. He didn't say the book would win it, though.
Whatever it takes. All right, Your Honor. What's the biggest thing you learned in those 17 months?
Anything is possible. Really, you know, with the perspective of 10 years now in hindsight, when I was going through it, Jack, it was head down, blinders on, get this deal, get the next deal, get the next deal, get the next deal. But with the perspective of time, what it is really about and what the Detroit bankruptcy is about people coming together. People from all points on the demographic, geographic, political, cultural, racial compass coming together to rescue a great city. And we need more of that in our society. We're so divided. I mean, people are so polarized. And really the lesson of the Detroit bankruptcy, and particularly the grand bargain, is that people can still come together.
Speaking of people coming together in the future, so many of our cities, townships, our states, yet alone our federal government, Jerry, I think they're in the same boat that Detroit was in. What's going to happen?
Well, there's a big difference. Many of our municipalities are in denial, and they just think that they can tax and spend their way out, and they can't. That's what happened in Detroit. People started voting with their feet. Chicago is just one example. The pension funds in Chicago are more than $65 billion underfunded, and they just keep raising taxes, and businesses are leaving. California, the same thing. Jack, I wonder if I could just conclude with reading three sentences from the introduction of the book.
Please.
This book is not so much a story about the tick-tock of the bankruptcy case itself as it is about the collective heart of the small group of extraordinary people at the center of the vortex. This is the story of those people and the events that consumed them. I hope that this story will resonate in every corner of our country where faith in democratic government and civil discourse is flickering.
Jake, thanks for convincing Dad to do this. Your Honor, thanks for having the courage and the guts to do it.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Looking back now, 10 years, what's amazed you the most about Detroit's rebirth?
How quickly it has happened. We are now, I was with the mayor when he received news that we had gotten our 10th credit rating increase in 10 years. That's almost unfathomable. We now have amongst the highest credit ratings of all the major cities. People are coming back. The kids who left for Chicago and New York and L.A. and Florida are coming back to open businesses, little restaurants. The entrepreneurship is reinvigorated in Detroit, and it's just, it's wonderful to see. It's pretty obvious I love this city, and to see the rebirth is just, it's almost unbelievable. But, Jack, anything can happen, as you say.
You're the architect of the grand bargain. Half the people think you're an angel. The other half think you're a devil. Great courage that you showed us through those 17 months. Talk about courage, which we all need today, Jerry.
Well, my hero in history is Winston Churchill. I believe that if you believe in something, you stand up and be counted. And you don't put your finger in the wind and see which way the wind is blowing. You stand up and be counted. In the world of politics, we don't have enough people who are doing that and trying to bring people together. And that does take courage.
Jerry Rosen, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is action in the face of fear. Mm. And, sir, you live that, and we're all better for it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.
Believe in yourself.